Have you liked and shared Unfound's Facebook page yet? Unfound has now covered 328 disappearances over the course of over 400 episodes. It has an interview-based format and concentrates on the facts, not the theories. Today, and for the 17th time, I will take you back to the beginning, then right up to the present, as I cover news over the past 4 months pertaining to many of Unfound's cases. I'm Ed Dentzel, and this is Unfound. But first, Unfound news. If you're in the Tampa area, you might run into me if you attend the presentation Psychology of Serial Killers at the Capitol Theater in Clearwater next Friday, April 26th. Of course, just look for the hair. Next, we're getting near the end of the month, so be looking for the next Unfound Now episode on YouTube, where I analyze a very recent disappearance. Finally, there's a poll going on in the discussion group on Facebook right at this second. Please go there and take part now. The question, what percentage of Unfound episodes have you listened to? Man, I hate ending sentences with prepositions. Okay, let's get started. And if you're wondering, well, isn't the update episode usually not until the end of April? That's true, but all I can say is we just had a change in the scheduling, and that's really all I can say right now, because talking about it will just tick me off. So, if you're new to Unfound, or maybe you forget, this is how I do these updates. I go through all of the disappearances, and I, of course, as you know, I try to keep up with as many as I can, even though there's like 320 some of them now, but I do the best that I can. And I'm not going to say I haven't missed an update or two over the past 5 years or how long ever I've been doing these update episodes, but I go through all of them and I check to see if there are, if there's any new news. This just not mean, certainly a lot of these get news coverage, but what we're looking for is new information is really what I'm looking for when I'm going back through. And so I go back through all of the disappearances and the Unfound Nows, the series on YouTube, the monthly series on YouTube, and I see if there's any new information for any of those disappearances. Any new information that has occurred in the past 4 months. So going back to the beginning of 2024 up to the present. So no new information that came out in 2023 or 2022 or any other time is going to be included. Only new information for disappearances covered by Unfound, and that new information has occurred in the past roughly 4 months. And all I do is jot down a little notes. There is no necessarily no script. I'm not reading anything, although I may for – there's a couple news stories that I'll be reading. But really, for the most part, just like when I did the Q&A episode – just have a few notes or maybe nothing, maybe just a word, and that's enough for me to cue me to, oh yeah, this is the update for that particular disappearance. So please excuse any of no's and pregnant pauses and ers and ums and maybe a little bad English here and there because I'm doing 99.9% of this off the top of my head. All I have are a few notes for each disappearance in front of me. So let's get started. And oh, by the way, one more thing. I go from the oldest episodes to the newest episodes for both the podcast and Unfound Now. So I go chronologically. First update. MH370 was a Malaysian Airlines flight originating in Kuala Lumpur. The destination was Beijing, China. On the night of March 8th, 2014, while flying over the South China Sea, all of its communication equipment was shut off, making it invisible to air traffic control. An hour later, Malaysian military radar tracked the flight heading northwest up the Malacca Strait. Flight 370 was never seen again. Now, the update here is that I appeared on Jeff Wise's podcast, Deep Dive, back in, we filmed it March, and it came out, I think, in March. So it's been just very recently here that I did that, and that was actually when I was up seeing my dad during the month of March of 2024. So he and I had been talking about this for a while. He started this podcast going very deep into the minutiae of the disappearance of Flight 370, and he told me he was going to be starting that podcast, and way back when he had said, well, you got to come on and at some time, because I've written things to him, insights to him, since he appeared back in 2017 on Unfound, and even published one of my messages. It was more like a whole blog post on his blog, if you want to go find it, at jeffwise.net. He just doesn't talk about Flight 370 there. He covers a whole range of topics there. But he's gotten to be a good friend of mine, although we've never met in person. It's really weird. I was just watching some plane crash shows over the last couple days on Paramount Plus, and there he was from like 12 years ago or something like that. And so he was well known well before he became a prominent speaker and an analyst for and writer author for Flight 370. So I appeared on his podcast back in March. I hope you checked it out. If not, go do that after you're done listening to this update episode. I have to admit that if it were my show and if I were being interviewed about Flight 370, that I probably would have taken it in a different direction. But it's his show. He wanted to talk about some particular items, and I was more than happy to do that. Certainly, if I were to go on there again, I wish, you know, maybe we would have a deeper talk about Flight 370 and how it can be compared to just more of your, I guess, what we may call, quote unquote, the run-of-the-mill disappearances. Because, amazingly, there are a lot of similarities. And I've kind of passed this along to him through email over the many months, if not years now. That just wasn't what he wanted to talk about. We talked when I appeared, when he interviewed me, I don't know, was it a month ago now, something like that. He wanted to talk about my magic background and how magicians make things disappear, even though I'm not a magician myself. But for 4 years, I was a stage manager for a magic show. And I must have done, what, 1,000 shows or something as a stage manager, something like that, some crazy number. And got to work with them, saw how they put some of their tricks together, and got to see behind the scenes. I do not reveal necessarily any tricks. I'm not a magician, never aspired to be one. That was just a job I had, although it was very cool. Don't think I gave any tricks away while I was on Jeff's show. So, but it's all about misdirection. And of course, that's kind of what Jeff believes regarding Flight 370. That if the plane was hijacked, it wasn't done by the pilot. It was by a passenger or passengers. It was a misdirection, making it look like it went to the southern Indian Ocean when really it went somewhere else, Russia, Kazakhstan, wherever. And so it's a form of magic. You know, what a magician does is look at my left hand where really the trick's happening in my right hand. So we talked a little bit about that. And so I hope if you've not listened to it yet, please go and find that episode within the last month. It's called Deep Dive. It's about Flight 370. There are 30 some episodes now. I don't know how many more they're going to be honest with you. But you want to check that out. If you've not listened to it yet, you got, of course, a lot of listening to do, but it's well worth it. It does get a little technical, as it did when I interviewed him. That was certainly the most technical interview I ever did regarding a disappearance when Jeff was on way back in 2017. But Flight 370 is still missing, and Jeff continues to be right in that he said way back when that the jet would not be found on the floor of the Indian Ocean. He continues to be correct about that. And despite those parts being found on the coast of Africa, I think there's reasons to question whether they're legitimate or not, if there's some sort of scam or scheme going on. So that's the update. I appeared on that podcast. Please check it out. And please follow that podcast and give it a nice review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Next update, Lucinda Hules. This was the most recent revisitation episode. Lucinda Hules was a 17-year-old from Tampa, Florida. She had gotten married at 15 and already had two children. On October 27th, 1984, Lucinda went out to a club with a couple of new friends. After midnight, the two wanted to leave, but Lucinda decided to stay. She was never seen again. And I'd picked that one out. I'd actually had a couple that were kind of bouncing around up in my head as the next, as far as revisitation episodes. What do we do? About three or four of those a year. Want to make sure we never forget about the old episodes of Unfound and disappearances that were featured very early on in Unfound's existence, where it did not have as many listeners as it does now. And I realize some people, when they find out about Unfound, start going back from the beginning or something. But I think a lot of people just kind of maybe pick up wherever they're starting here, and maybe in 2024. And then they figure, well, when I have time, I'll go back and listen to some of the older episodes. So I try to spur that along by including an old episode once in a while, but I always include new commentary. So that was a revisitation episode that came out in, what was it? I think in early March sometime. I think that came out while I was up at my dad's in Pennsylvania. And so that's the update. But what I want to add to that was that I think my opinion on that disappearance has changed at least a little bit. I think, of course, I've grown a lot. I've learned a lot about disappearances since Lucinda's daughter was on the podcast way back when, and I think it was actually 2017. I've learned a lot. And back then, it was like, oh, this was 100% foul play. And I think that foul play is still the most prominent choice. But it's interesting that when I had a chance to talk about this disappearance with the think tank, and once again, I'm going to say it again, you all should be part of the think tank on Patreon. Please sign up. You're going to enjoy it. It's going to be well worth it. I know some of you are already supporting other podcasts, YouTube channels, or whatever on Patreon. Maybe think about a change. I think we're doing good work here. If you think Unfound is doing good work, you should be part of the think tank. It's going to mean something. Being part of the think tank, signing up, it means something. It's constructive work. And you get to talk to me and a lot of other listeners in a very private way, in depth, and then I take that information back to the guests. So it's more than just supporting. You're actually having Unfound. You're actually having an impact on how the future investigation of that disappearance could go. So think about it. But it was interesting in talking to the members of the think tank about Lucinda's, because we did not get to do that because the think tank didn't exist back in 2017, but we got to do it now. Some things about her, you know, her possessions being left in that men's room at Busch Gardens, and really trying to put together a scenario, a foul play scenario that made sense, start thinking about it. It's a little tough. It's pretty, pretty difficult to do that. And if so, she did get abducted by somebody, why didn't somebody just take everything? And if this is something where she was taken into that men's room or lured in there, then why were there no signs of a struggle or anything like that? And how far would she have to have been dragged or carried or whatever else to a car or something? And why would that person leave her stuff there and then, of course, making it look like she actually was abducted? It's a little hard to understand. And in that way, her disappearance is unique. So I think that at least a little bit I've backed away from the foul play angle. And you have to remember, she was very young. She was only 17, already had two kids. She was already married. And I can't really rule out the idea that she just started a new life somewhere. I'm more open to that. I'm not saying it's over 50%. It's certainly not. But just the way, listening to the interview again, talking to the members of the think tank, really tapping into everything that we've covered on Unfound, you know, all 300-some disappearances now, it's just opened my mind to that a little more. Whereas, like I said, back in 2017, oh, this is absolutely foul play, no doubt. Now, not as sure. I realize there might have been a serial killer in the area at the time, but it really didn't fit that guy's modus operandi and leaving the possessions behind and things. So I was really open to the idea that it was some guy there who knew Lucinda. It was one of the women, one of her guy friends that did something. Not as sure about that now, especially considering Lucinda's age. So there you go. That's the update. It was a revisitation episode. I was happy to do that again. And you should know, within the last couple of years, Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office actually had a podcast for a little while. They actually talked about Lucinda's disappearance on that podcast as well. I think it was called Unfinished Business. It only ran for a short time. I don't know why it stopped. But you might find that out there somewhere as well. It's out there. It's just the podcast isn't going on, I think, these days. But I think those episodes are still available if you want to see what the Pinellas or Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office has to say about Lucinda's disappearance from the 1980s. Next update, Donald Irwin. Now, this is really just a follow-up. Donald Irwin was a 59-year-old from Camdenton, Missouri. He was a Navy veteran and loved to tinker with electronics and machines. On December 29th, 2013, he got up early, as he usually did, and headed down to the local store to pick up some cigarettes. He was never seen again. It was, of course, we were still waiting for the scientific evidence, I think, back at the end of December when the last update episode came out. But now it's for sure. Donald Irwin was found, and he was identified as being deceased. Remember that his car was found, but they said that there was no body in it. And then they said that, well, they found human remains in that pond, and they still need to be tested. Well, we now know that for sure, that Donald Irwin was dead in that pond. And it doesn't sound to me like there's any chance of foul play. You should know, I still don't know where this pond is. I will admit that I've not had a chance to talk to any of his family members recently. I've not asked. I asked that back at the time when it was going on, but it was still an ongoing investigation. But I've not attempted to ask that recently, so I don't know now if it's a big secret or not. I have to admit that. This is a disappearance. I think at the time when the episode came out, that maybe some people were thinking, well, you know, his wife was acting kind of strange and she was having people over and everything. But I think we can say with quite a bit of certainty now that there was no foul play, and that Donald chose to end his life on his own terms. I will admit that driving your car into a pond, that seems like an unusual way, but I still think that that's what happened. It's hard for me to think about that because I don't have those kind of thoughts. I can maybe understand why people jump off bridges or jump out of buildings or use a gun or something like that. But this seems like a pretty slow, you know, agonizing way to take your own life to me. And I'm going to guess that this way is not chosen by too many people. Now, we do know, of course, I guess it's kind of the same thing as people jumping off of cruise ships. And I think a lot of those are suicides, although certainly some of those people could be drunk and maybe not totally understand what they're doing. But I certainly believe a lot of those are suicides as well. It kind of feels to me like that. You know, if you jump off the top railing of a cruise ship and you don't die after you hit the water, that's going to be, I can't even think about it. It's just morbid, sad, depressing. That's a slow way to go. And that's kind of how I look at this with Donald, but I think that's what happened. So once again, we have a situation where a missing person is found with his car. And I continue to say, although there is an exception like Eric Franks, for the most part, the longer a disappearance goes where a person and his or her car are missing, more likely they are going to be found together. I guess Nico Lisi's is another exception. And forgive me, I have some sinus stuff going on here. This is another, maybe it's just a theory. It's not a law because there are exceptions to it, but it's a pretty good guess that when you get to disappearances being this old like Donald's, that you're most likely going to find the person and the car together. And so, very sad, but I don't think that the result here is a surprise. Next update. Al Copper, and this is just kind of a interesting story. Albert Leroy Copper was a 28-year-old from Avonmore, Pennsylvania. He was a new father and loved working on Mustangs. On June 6th, 2013, he got up early, as he usually did, to head to work. Albert never arrived at his job, and his car was found abandoned on a dirt trail later that morning. He was never seen again. When I was up seeing my dad in March, he was getting his taxes done, and he had to take them to a tax guy that he's known for, I don't know, way back since his teaching days, which is a long, long time ago now, in a town called Vandergrift, which is in Westmoreland County, and which is near where I grew up in Leechburg, not kind of very near where my dad lives now, though. And it just so happened, I went with him there with my dad. We parked, and he's, like I said, he's known this guy for a while, so he wanted to stick around and talk for a little bit. But both the tax guy and this woman who works with him, I don't know if it's assistant secretary, maybe she does taxes too, I'm not totally sure. Well, they both live in Avonmore, coincidentally, where Al Copper went missing. And so I don't think that they probably, at least the guy knew that my dad has a son, me. And so we started, of course, I'm there. My dad's dropping off this tax stuff. And, or was he paying? I think we were picking it up, actually. And they mentioned, he mentioned, well, you know, Ed does these these disappearances, and I have this podcast and everything. And I don't know if it was I who brought it up or they brought it up about Avonmore, but somehow I said, oh, you're from Avonmore. Yeah, I covered a disappearance there. Al Copper, and they remember that. Of course, Al's disappearance fairly new. And we started talking about his disappearance and how, you know, people were really puzzled and everything. But I got the sense that, and this is one of those maybe interviews that I think if I were doing it now in 2024, that it might go a little differently than it did back then. That we probably would have tampered down some of the speculation, some of the stories that Al's brother Matt wanted to tell. And I think both of these people who once lived there in Avonmore were there when it happened, still continue to live there. And Avonmore is a very, very small town. Very small. Even smaller than the town where I grew up at Leechburg. That they, I think they were much more grounded in what they suspected happened to Elle. They did not really believe in any foul play allegations or conspiracy or anything like that. Just the local thinking on his disappearance is just a guy who had some things going on and decided to leave his life or commit suicide. I don't think anybody there is really thinking that it was foul play. So it was interesting to me. I didn't expect to get that while I was in Pennsylvania, getting the local insight into Al Copper's disappearance, but I did. And it was interesting to get some locals' insight into it, especially since I don't think either of them are into true crime or into disappearances or anything else. But you know, I don't get that too often, being that I'm here in Clearwater Beach, Florida. And I'd love to, one of these days, I'd love to go to all of the areas, every single spot where we've covered disappearances on Unfound. In fact, my brother and I have talked about that with his RV, but that's not going to happen anytime soon. But we've thrown around the idea, at least. So maybe one of these days I'll get to do that. And I think I would really enjoy that. Not just getting to me. Of course, a lot of these families still live in the areas where the disappearance occurred. But maybe going around and talking to locals about the disappearances and see what they have to say. So I got a chance to do that. And it was interesting. And more and more, I think that Al was going through some stuff and dumped his car and took off into the woods somewhere by himself. And that there was no foul play. So that's the update. Getting to talk to some locals, actually people who live in Avonmore, and get their insight into Al Copper's disappearance. Next update, Tom Brown. Thomas Kelly Brown was an 18-year-old from Canadian, Texas. He was president of his class and loved acting and public speaking. On the night of November 23rd, 2016, Thomas was on his way home after hanging out with friends. He stopped to get gas in his Dodge Durango. He was never seen again. What I have here, one of the few things that I will be reading for this update episode is the continuing litigation, I guess you might call it, between Phil Klein and Michael Crane and others in the Canadian Amarillo area of Texas. So this was posted on Phil Klein's Facebook page back in March. Over the past week, we have received press inquiries into the rumors of this firm entering into a lawsuit under the Texas Open Records Act with the city of Abernathy, Texas, in the Thomas Brown case. We can confirm the rumors to be true. This past November, we were advised by state law enforcement that Michael Crane, who reported himself to be a former quote-unquote state investigator and a former Navy SEAL to the public and former employers on a radio show, was employed by USA Investigations of Lubbock, Texas. According to state records, he still is. As well, the company's president is Dwayne Reed. According to government documents, Mr. Reed is also the police chief in the city of Abernathy, Texas. In further examination, it was determined that Pine Gregory, who was involved in the Thomas Brown case as a police officer and left under the suggestion of a Brady notice for his actions as a police officer for the Hemphill County Sheriff's Office, was employed with the city of Abernathy and under the management of Chief Reed. As well, Gregory found Mr. Gregory found Tom's body. In December of 2023, this firm filed a 552 request for open records request for certain documents on both Chief Reed and Officer Gregory. In January, we did not receive an answer within the 10-day notice period. In fact, we received zero correspondence. This firm filed a second 552 request once again, and again within the 10-day notice period, we received zero correspondence. Contact was then made with the mayor of the city and the city attorney. Received an email from the lawyer for the city who said he would help with the matter. Then, after two more weeks, we heard nothing after emailing the attorney and his paralegal. During the entire time, we heard nothing from the mayor of Abernathy. As well, the city attorney stopped all communications with us. This past month, we sent a letter to the Texas Attorney General in notification of the violation of the state mandated time period and the state mandated document return under the law. The state gave as well clearance to the file suit against the city of Abernathy for the requested documents and fully unredacted information as the time expired period expired, and the city of Abernathy lost all rights to withhold any of the documents. There is no appeal. The city of Abernathy will be responsible for all legal fees. We believe, again, that the employees of the government and their counsel work for the people of Texas, ignoring a lawful filing and bringing down a shade of non-transparency creates more transparency creates more questions than answers. But that has been the problem in the Brown case. And Philip R. Klein, lead investigator. You're probably asking me, what do I make of this? I don't know. I have no idea. I mean, are we saying now, I don't know. Does somebody in Abernathy know what happened to Tom Brown? I get it. I mean, although we don't file a lot of FOIAs here, which may be different what they're talking about here, it's not unusual to not get anything back. And it's not unusual for some jurisdiction to not, they have so many days or whatever to get back and they don't get back to you. Never had it occurred to me. And like I said, we haven't done this much because I don't like waiting around for information like that. Sometimes, although I did get information, a big, huge file for Jennifer Perry from a few years ago. Very surprised by that. But it's never occurred to me that filing for information and they don't get back to me, that I would ever file suit against them or anything. Maybe I should. Maybe Phil Klein's teaching me that I should. I don't know. I get it that Phil Klein's ticked off at Michael Crane. I think for very good reasons. I'm not taking a side here. I think everybody knows my attitude toward Phil Klein and Michael Crane and all of this. That I, of course, have not taken sides on any of this. I really don't have a lot of respect for any of these people. I'm not saying they're shady or corrupt or anything else. I think this has just become sensationalism all around. And a lot of people are to blame for that. So I don't know where this is going. Here's what I think I know. Phil Klein could have gotten all of this information just as he wanted, and we still wouldn't be any closer to knowing absolutely 100% what happened to Tom Brown, whether it was a suicide, an accident, a murder, or anything else. I'm pretty sure about that. I guess by the letter of the law, Philip Klein is correct here. Doesn't seem to me that in this statement that he made on his Facebook page, and he can write, I guess, anything he wants on his Facebook page. I suppose Facebook could delete it, but for the most part, Facebook's probably going to let you write whatever you want to write. I think it's still fairly unclear here what he's hoping to get out of this information in the first place. Maybe he would like to do another Facebook post on that. What are you looking to exactly get? Just because Michael Crane's employed there or Pine Gregory's employed there, what are you implying? So I can't imagine anything of this really, really, really has anything to do with the investigation into what actually happened to Tom. That's the way I look at it. I may be proven wrong. If I am, I'll let you know. Next update, Peggy McGuire. Peggy Ann McGuire was a 28-year-old from Eufaula, Oklahoma. She had a son and raised farm animals. On November 16th, 2015, Peggy dropped her son off at school. Her plan was to then go home to work on plans for a new porch on her house. She was never seen again. The update here is that there was a new search, and I'm going to read the article to you right now. Peggy McGuire was declared missing in November of 2015, last seen in McIntosh County. 8 years later, no progress has been made with the search for her until now. On Wednesday, not like this past Wednesday, it's been a little while. Like I said, this is all information since the beginning of January. On Wednesday, the Muskogee County Sheriff's Office followed up on a tip. The McGuire's body is wrapped in chicken wire, held down under the surface of a pond south of Washington Avenue in the town of Oktaha. I know I just butchered that. There were some people that knew Peggy back in 2015. They were hearing stuff. They were talking amongst themselves, one place or the other. One gentleman has moved away, and he's the person that's been calling us and saying you might want to go to Oktaha and check the pond. I believe she's going to be in there, said Bert Poole, an investigator with the Muskogee County District Attorney's Office. The Sheriff's Office and the Light Horse Police Department began their search just before noon on Wednesday. After about 3 hours of searching, unfortunately, there wasn't any clues. Poole said they will continue to search for McGuire to give her family answers. We can contact our resources or contact the people that's been calling us and maybe get another area of the pond, but we're just not going to give up. We want to try again to locate a victim for a family who really needs to have that closure, Poole said. McGuire's mother shared the following video seeking help from the community as she continues searching for her daughter. My understanding on all of this is to also remind you to go maybe go a few more into the details of her disappearance. Was it her ex-husband or estranged husband? Was it the house? And, of course, he claimed that whether she didn't come home or if he wasn't there when she came home or he didn't see her come home, something like that. And I'm not sure a lot of people in that area are necessarily believing that. And there was also a story that he was seen that morning driving down the road in like a, what do they call them, a high lift, like, or with the bucket in the front that was like raised way high in the air, and he was just flying down the road in one of these types of machinery. Or was it a backhoe? You know, like they have the one claw in the back, but they have like a bucket type of mechanism in the front. Look at me. Can't explain these things, even though I worked for the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation for 3 summers. But it was something like that, and he was going down the road, and this high lift, this bucket was raised high in the air. And, of course, Peggy was never seen again. My understanding is where she lived and this pond, not really that close to each other. So my interpretation, could be wrong, is that this is just locals talking. Just rumors floating about. I'm glad the police are want to act on some of it, you know, give it a shot. I'm happy about that. It's been 9 years and they're still willing to go out and go into a pond and do that. That's more than a lot of police departments are going to do. Hence the reason that Adventures with Purpose and Chaos Divers and all these other groups exist now. But it just kind of has that feeling that this was a rumor circulating around and there really weren't any facts to back it up. And so that's the update for Peggy McGuire. Next update, Angie Yarnell. Michelle Angela Yarnell, Angie to those who loved her most, was a 28-year-old from Ivy Bend, Missouri. She was a big Cyndi Lauper fan and loved animals. On October 25th, coincidentally my mother's birthday, 2003, her husband came home from work to find her gone. He later told Angie's family that she ran off with another man. She was never seen again. Of course, we now know that he ended up changing his story. The husband changed his story that Angie hit her head and died, and then he wanted to give her a burial out in this island in some lake there. And while he was taking her body out to the lake, the body fell out of the canoe or boat or raft or whatever it was, and he couldn't find her body in the water. That's the story he told. And he ended up going to jail for a few years, and now he is a free man. The update for this is, very unfortunately, that Angie's mother, Marianne Asher Chapman, died. Very sad. And actually, Angie's father died just a couple years ago. But Marianne was the guest for the episode. And she was just not Angie's mother. She was a force to behold. Once her daughter went missing and everything, she came a huge advocate, worker, volunteer within the missing persons community. And my impression is that at least a few of Unfound's other guests knew her, even though their loved ones didn't disappear in Missouri. That is how well known Marianne Asher Chapman was. And when I think of Marianne, although I had not spoken to her for a while before she died, that she was known to go out by herself, you know, of course, after her husband died, she would just go out and look for her daughter in the woods. She'd take a shovel, she'd take other piece tools, and she would just walk around that area of Ivy Bend, Missouri, looking for her daughter. Of course, the reason she was doing that is because she didn't believe the husband's story about how Angie ended up in a lake. I mean, can you imagine? It's just, oh, baby. Overwhelming to think that anybody would just randomly go out there into the woods. No other help, nothing. Just her and nature going out there trying to find her daughter. It's just, it's very powerful. It's also very tragic. And you love to see that kind of energy, but in a way also it's very melancholy. So, but she was a force. That's what I remember about her. I think that's the way a lot of people who knew her thought of her. And she became a great spokesperson within the missing persons community. And it's very, very sad to see her go. And she wasn't, I don't think she was even 70 years old yet. And on that note, maybe at this time I should tell you that it's now, and we're going to mention another death of another guest here in a bit, but that's now 10 guests of Unfound who have died. And I will just read them off to you right now. Vicki Wilkerson, mother of Jennifer Wilkerson. Jessica Curtis, of course, sister of Tyler Stice. Tessie Palmer, mother of Marina Bolter. Janice Norwood, mother of Kimberly Norwood. Of course, Marianne Asher Chapman. Katie Lancaster, sister-in-law of Megan Lancaster. Donna Jean Kapp, sister of Dorianne Myers. Tanya Washburn, that would be April Andrews' half-sister. She was the guest. And then the one we're going to get to is Joanne Decker, sister of Shelva Rafty. And then another one we're going to get to, another person who has died within the last few months, is Bruce Ricketts, who was not a family member, but he was the guest for the disappearance of those six young men in Canada, the Pickering Six. And of course, talk a little bit more about him when we get to Joanne and Bruce. So that is now Vicki, Jessica, Tessie, Janice, Marianne, Katie, Donna Jean, Tanya, Joanne, Bruce. That's now 10. And what do I say every time? And because I mean it, it hurts every time. Next update, Tyler North. Tyler North was a 27-year-old from Harlan County, Kentucky. He was the father of two and loved hunting and fishing. On the evening of Sunday, June 24th, 2018, Tyler left his sister's. He was allegedly headed home. However, Tyler turned into a local park. Instead, he was never seen again. I think this is one I think that has made it in every update episode for the last couple years. We're still waiting for that trial of his ex-wife, her boyfriend. There was somebody else who was involved like after the fact. We're still waiting for a trial, this murder trial. But I've heard a little birdie has told me maybe that it's going to be happening in May. So like a month from now sometime. We shall see. But I mean, they've been in custody for a while now. I mean, I've been talking about this for a while. Why is it taking so long? I don't know exactly what's going on. In Kentucky, they don't seem to be as efficient as maybe Colorado and how quickly they charged and then brought Steve Pankey to trial twice. But when the trial happens, I will keep tabs on it and I'll let you know. But no trial yet. Next update, and probably one of the biggest updates Unfound has ever done in all 17 episodes of update episodes. Mary Jane Van Gilder was a 34-year-old living alone in Shelby, Ohio. She was a mother of five and worked at a World War II depot. Around the beginning of April 1945, Mary Jane's oldest daughter, who lived in West Virginia, started receiving the letters back that she had tried to mail to her mother. Mary Jane had seemingly moved without giving a forwarding address. She was never seen again. This is still the oldest disappearance Unfound has ever covered, but is now not the oldest unsolved disappearance, because back in February, it was revealed that Mary Jane Van Gilder had been tracked down. And this disappearance had been solved 100%. There is no room for conjecture or more theorizing or anything else. She was found. And so now the oldest unsolved disappearance that we've covered was just what we covered recently with Heather Grotman. And that was Ricky Jean Bryant. So the big news here is from Shelby, Ohio. While the mystery of what happened to Mary Jane Van Gilder has been solved, questions about her two lives likely will linger forever. Shelby Police Detective Adam Turner has doggedly pursued the case for the last 5.5 years. He held a press conference Monday morning, back in February. My sister was there. At the Kehoe Center to announce the results of investigation. Van Gilder had last been seen in the Shelby area in 1945. Originally from West Virginia, Van Gilder moved to Ohio in 1944 to work at the Wilkins Army Air Force Depot in Shelby. If you don't know, at one time the Army and Air Force were all one division of the United States military. On March 8, 1945, she resigned from her job, citing added household duties. It turns out Van Gilder had a second secret life and family, and neither family knew about the other. It's not quite right about how that's written. In October 2018, the Shelby Police Department received a Facebook message from Mindy Wilson, one of Van Gilder's granddaughters. Police Chief Lance Combs assigned the case to Turner, who's been looking ever since. Turner caught a break in the cold case when he obtained Van Gilder's military file and published it online. A civilian sleuth, as Turner called her, had been following the case. In November 2023, the woman came across the name Percy L. Sebrin, S-E-B-R-E-N. When Van Gilder was promoted to high lift fork operator, she took the position from Sebrin and likely received training from him. This name was among dozens of others located throughout Mary Jane's military file, but it would be this one alone that would prove crucial. Searching Sebrin's history on findagrave.com, Turner learned the man died in Kansas City, Missouri in 1969. It also showed he was married to a Mary J. Sebrin. who was born on November 19th, 1911, and died in 1990, both were buried in Forest, Louisiana. Sebrin had been run over by a train. He and his wife had two sons, one in 1945, the second in 1947. The older son was born 9 months after Van Gilder left her position at the Wilkins Army Air Force Depot. This was probably the reason for enlisting added household duties, Turner said. He did, however, track down one of the Sebrin's granddaughters, Bobby Sebrin, providing him with photos of her grandmother from the late 1970s and early 1980s. She told me that she didn't know much about her grandmother's life and that it was not discussed. The detective contacted Moxie Forensic Investigations through a side-by-side photo enhancement. He also received a document from the grandchildren with her signature. Comparing it to Mary Jane Van Gilder's signature showed distinct similarities in how each letter was shaped and formatted. Mary Jane Sebrin had somehow obtained and was using a different Social Security number than the one we found in her military file. Turner was getting closer. Additional photos of Mary Jane and her husband confirmed what Turner already knew. A DNA test made it official. Mary Jane Sebrin was, without a doubt, Mary Jane Van Gilder. According to the grandchildren from her second family, Mary Jane was the perfect grandmother. She loved to garden, with her favorite flower being the hydrangea. My mother's up in heaven saying, Ed, you just killed the name of that flower. She liked sun tea and was a great cook. Sebrin / Van Gilder died from colon cancer. She was cremated and buried next to her husband after living the majority of her life after 1945 in Arkansas. So Mary Jane Van Gilder ran off with her, I guess he might have been her superior, probably because they were having an affair. She got pregnant, knew she couldn't go back to West Virginia being pregnant. So she ran off with him, and she lived in the southern United States, had another child with this guy. He ended up dying in 1969, got hit by a train. Was that suicide? I don't know for no. But she lived until 1990. And there's the rest of the story here that I'm not going to read. But what came out from this presentation back in February was that Mary Jane, knowing that she was going to die, had told one of her grandchildren that she had a big secret and that she hoped nobody would ever find out. Well, I don't know. Maybe unfortunately for her or fortunate for us, or I don't know how you want to look at it. Well, we now know what that big secret was. And I'm guessing that she must have lived from 1945 to 1990, 45 years, always looking over her shoulder. Now, what she couldn't have probably guessed, I don't know how many people could have guessed it back, any lay people anyway, that DNA would become along in the 1990s and would be able to test people and it would become, you know, very sophisticated science. She probably could have never guessed that in 1990. I'm guessing that when she died, she thought the probability of anybody ever figuring out who she really was probably was next to zero. And, of course, it did take, once DNA came in the mid-1990s, it still took almost 30 years. But science finally caught up with Mary Jane Van Gilder. And, you know, a couple things here, though. I asked Adam this a couple days after the presentation because it wasn't – I don't think he ever talked about it in the presentation or it wasn't clear to me. Did she and this new guy get married? Adam has never been able to find a marriage certificate. So it very well may be that they pretended to be married, but they couldn't get married because she didn't have a proper identification. That is a possibility. I think what this also means is that this new guy knew that she was married and that she had a family in West Virginia. I'm pretty sure about that. Being that you can't find a marriage certificate, and it seemed like they were pretending to be married, that kind of gives, what do they say, like an air of guilt, like a guilty conscience or something like that, I guess is the feeling that I get about it. Because, like I said, when this all came out, there was talk. Well, did he know? Did he even know that, you know, he was running off with a woman who already had a husband and kids? I think he did. And so, of course, he would have been worrying about probably looking over his shoulder too. Worrying that his wife, although technically he wasn't, you know, she wasn't his wife. Worried that she was going to get caught for what she did and everybody would find out about it and everything else. So probably lived, of course, he lived, what, 24 years, 45 to 69 with him. But she had to live that with that for 45 years. Can't imagine it. Of course, the other big issue regarding this, and I hope everybody will remember this whole thing, it's a cliche within the true crime community, and I hate it. The saying, well, she would never leave her kids. We hear that so much. Well, I guess we hear it with guys too. He would never leave his kids. Parents are leaving their children all the time. It's disgusting and everything. Now, I get, you know, and having seen some conversations that have happened since this all came out in February, she was thinking, she might have been thinking, well, she was pregnant, I'm pretty sure. So once again, that kind of paints her into a corner about what she could do. But I have to admit, I'm not even inclined to believe that she would have gone back to West Virginia if she wasn't pregnant. I think she saw a way out of an abusive relationship. She thought that otherwise that her husband, although she was abusive to her, he wasn't abusive to the kids, that they would be fine, and she decided to move on. I think this happens more than we know, although maybe it doesn't involve the changing of identities and everything else. So parents do leave their kids. It's just something that happens. So we can't always just use that. That is just a cliche. Now, when we get into like the man said type of disappearances, and you know they're living under the same roof, and the guy says, "I don't know what happened to her. You know, her car's here, her purse here, her phone's here, everything else. I don't know what happened to her." Of course, we have a really good inkling what happened. Yes, those women did not leave their kids. But outside of those types of scenarios, I'm inclined to believe that women leave their children and men leave their children. So I tend to be a little more open-minded on this topic than I think most of the people who take an interest in disappearances and murders, just the general true crime community. I'm much more open-minded to this than I think most people are. So if you're ever wondering, if you're ever really questioning that, maybe getting into that cliche mode, just remember Mary Jane Van Gilder. Had kids back in West Virginia, ran off with another guy, lived with him for 45 years, seemingly lived an otherwise pretty good life. Everybody seemed to think very highly of her, but she left her kids. Shocker. I have to admit that when we featured Mary Jane's Van Gilder's disappearance, what was that, 3 years ago or something now? Of course, I guess logic would dictate that you think the most likely disappearance to not be solved is the oldest one you covered. Well, that is certainly, I was certainly maybe not thinking correctly about that. And so this is maybe what, 31, 32, 33, somewhere in there of disappearances that we've featured that have been solved now somewhere in there. And so we have like 300 others that are all of them being more recent that are still unsolved. Just weird how that works out sometimes. And by the way, I'll say one more thing about this. This is why nobody should ever give up hope. And I guess kind of fortunately that there were family members who were wondering what happened to Mary Jane Van Gilder for all these years that finally got to find out what happened to her. I guess it's a little bit bittersweet, but it's now a mystery that has been removed from their lives, and maybe they can rest a little easier because of that, even though they now know that she left her kids for another man. Next update, Phyllis Corbin. Phyllis Marie Corbin was a 16-year-old from St. Louis, Missouri. She had behavior issues that caused her to be sent to a juvenile shelter a couple of times. In late September of 1963, Phyllis was scheduled to be released after spending a month at the facility. According to paperwork, Phyllis left for home. The next day, someone allegedly saw her at a local bar. She was never seen again. Really can't say too much, can't get into any specifics on this. All that I will say is that this might be another Mary Jane Van Gilder situation where a woman has been tracked down who is still alive here in 2024 who could be Phyllis. And her DNA is being checked as we speak. And that is about all I can say about that. If you're wondering, well, what do you think this is? Does it sound real? Doesn't it sound real? And of course, I'm getting this information from the guest for that episode. At this point, it's very early on. I really don't know what to make of it. All that I will tell you, what the logic tells me, of course, we know how many times these disappearances fly in the face of logic, that this woman agreed to have her DNA tested tells me that this is probably not Phyllis. It seems to me that if this really was Phyllis, she would just spare all the drama and just say, yep, I'm her, I'm she, and this is what I've been doing all these years, but this woman, to my knowledge, has not done this. So, and I really can't get into how this all came about. That is all off the record, secret for now. But a woman has been swabbed. We'll see what the results are. Next update, Julie Wefflin. And pardon me once again, got this sinus stuff going on. Very unusual for this time of year for me. Julianne Wefflin was a 28-year-old from Deer Park, Washington. She worked for the Bonneville Power Administration and loved the outdoors. On September 16th, 1987, on her way home, Julie stopped at a substation to make sure it was working correctly. Julie never made it home. She was never seen again. Remember that when she didn't make it home, everybody started looking for her. They found her truck at the substation, and something of a violent nature had happened. Or I think her helmet, helmet was on the ground, and there were drag marks, and the truck door was open. You remember friend of the program, John Polis, who was a fellow employee of Julie's at the time, was the guest. I say that we need a lot more John Polises out there. If you can believe it, John is in his late 70s and is still teaching high school, is still a high school teacher. It's like he was this. He's had all these different kind of jobs. And he's in his late 70s teaching high school students. I can't even imagine it. But and he's a fascinating guy, even though he and I certainly differ on our theories regarding Julie's disappearance. Still, great guy, always interesting to talk to, very interesting guy. And like I said, we need more people like them, people who are willing to put their spare time and look into this in a very structured way, very logical way, very organized way. We need more people out there who are accountants and engineers and teachers and everything and everybody else, every other profession, who in their spare time maybe want to work on a disappearance like John has. So the update here is that John alerted me that there is a guy who has done some true crime writing that now wants to do a disappearance on wants to do a book on Julie's disappearance, and he wants to add in the two other women who went missing around the same time in that area. And I had a chance to talk to this guy when I was up seeing my dad in March of course last month. And we had a great conversation. How long did we talk? It was over a half hour, but maybe less than an hour. We really got into a few details. And I told him that I want to be a resource for him. I told him I certainly do have a certain point of view regarding Julie's disappearance. Just talked about my experience and kind of comparing it to other disappearances. And I think he found it all very interesting. At least if he didn't, he certainly made me feel like he did. But I think probably the best news about it is that, at least what he told me, he doesn't really he's not really leaning, and I don't even know if any of his particular theories will come out in his book. He told me that once he writes it, like a rough draft of it, he'd love for me to take a look at it and give my input on it. I can do that. It might take me some time to get through it, depending on how long the book is, but doesn't seem to be leaning very heavily toward Will Parks, which is, of course, John Polis's best suspect. I told this author exactly what I've kind of told you. Although I, don't make a lot of my theories known, but what makes more sense to me is that she was attacked and taken by somebody who knew she was going to be there by herself. That makes more sense to me than Will Parks just happening to drive by, happening to see her, happening to turn around or whatever, and nobody seeing any of this. Of course, there's this witness. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to believe this witness or not. It just seems unlikely to me. And where what seems more likely is, somebody who was somehow knew that she was going to be there. Of course, she's working one of the few females. If you remember, Julie, kind of easy on the eyes, very well could be a coworker, knew that she was going to be out there. She stops there. He pulls in pretending like he wants to help her and tries this, tries that, and an attack happens. Now, of course, that would take more time than somebody just drives by and just abducts her. But, any of these things are going to take time. She put up a fight. She was taken. She certainly wasn't looking to jump into a car. She certainly didn't hitchhike her way away from that location or anything. So any kind of scenario we're going to think about that goes along with what we know about the scene is going to take some time. Just the question is how much time. But that's the reason I just think that random abductions happen. Strangers, of course. Allegedly, Julie and Will were not strangers. But now what I'm finding out, I think this is what this guy told me, is that this whole thing about Julie and Will both being in this club, this hiking club or whatever it was, this came up in the conversation. Will was in it, but Julie was not. So that kind of then undermines this whole idea that Will was mad at Julie because she got him kicked out, or he liked her and she didn't like him or anything. What this guy told me is that she was not in that club. Will was, but she wasn't. So this even more kind of takes me in that direction of somebody knew that she was there and found out about it somehow at the end of that day. And went over there and did this to her. It very well might not have been something romantic. Maybe this person felt like maybe she took his position or something, or she got promoted and he didn't, or something like that. It doesn't necessarily, I guess, have to be sexual motivation, even though that usually is the most common motivation in these types of situations. So there you go. I guess a book's going to be coming out about Julie's disappearance along with these two other women. And when it does, I'll let you know. Next update. And this kind of, I foreshadowed this some minutes ago. Shelva Rafty. Shelva Jean Rafty was a 44-year-old from Pittston, Pennsylvania. She had four children and came from a large family. On the evening of May 28th, 2006, Shelva and her on-again, off-again boyfriend went to a graduation party. After, they went back to his place where they got into a fight, and Shelva decided to walk the mile and a half home. She was never seen again. Two things here. One, like I already mentioned, unfortunately, Shelva's one sister, if you remember going back to that episode, I actually interviewed two of her sisters. And I just recently, I've kind of let this slip, and I'll just make this public. I've kind of let this slip, keeping in contact with some of Unfound's guests, just to be honest. And I really put this as something that's important for me to do in 2024. And I'm trying to email at least one or two of them every day. And I was just going down the list, and I came to Shelva's disappearance. And so I thought that, you know, got to contact a man. I haven't talked to Joanne and Shirley for a while. And it was Shirley who got back to me, and we talked on the phone, and she let me know that Joanne actually died last summer, so the summer of 2023. It sounds like she had gotten sick. It doesn't sound to me like it was something that was sudden. It seems like she had been fighting maybe some illnesses for a while. So, very sad. And the thing about it is, originally when I found out about Shelva's disappearance, it was actually Joanne I spoke to first. And then Shirley came in, and like I said, we eventually did that interview, the three of us. So Joanne Decker, very sadly deceased. The other piece of information, and this is something that it's on my notes to follow up on now that I'm back here in Florida, that I really need to do this, is that Shirley put me in contact with somebody kind of new that's been helping her. And if that person is listening to this, I've been meaning to reach back out to you. Just a lot of things going on. People flaking on interviews and such, which always adds more stuff to my workload. I want to talk to this person, new person looking into this. If you remember Shelva's disappearance, certainly could believe that she went off all on her own. But on the other hand, there was enough information, I think, that was covered back in that episode to think that I guess it could be foul play too. This is not, it's kind of one of those tweeners. It's not absolutely 100% a walk-off, and it's not exactly 100% of the man said where you think the guy did it. It's very much in the middle of the range there, so it's just hard to say. So I hope I can talk to this person, this new person working with Shirley, and maybe we can have a very constructive conversation. But mainly, Joanne Decker is no longer with us. Very sad. Next update, Gregory Howes. Gregory Downs Howes was a 42-year-old from Mendocino County, California. He loved golf and was a playwright. On the evening of June 17th, 1997, Greg went to the Rancho Canada Golf Course in Carmel Valley to play a round, but he didn't come home that night. The next morning, Greg's cart and clubs were found on the 13th tee. He was never seen again. And the update here is, first of all, out of nowhere, a couple months ago, and this also was along the lines why I really, really got to keep better in touch with some of unfounds. Guests. Some of them I talk to all the time. They're on Facebook a lot. I'm on Facebook a lot. I'm easy to reach and everything, but then other ones aren't. And this is one of those. I, out of nowhere, a few months ago, got an email from Greg's wife. You remember her name is Sherry Glaser, G-L-A-S-E-R. She was the guest. Just out of nowhere. And it was great to hear from her. And I emailed her back. I think we had maybe just a couple emails back and forth, and that was about it. But it was great to hear from her. And I just what we talked about, I'm just going to keep it off the record. But what is also interesting to me, though, is that she has recently done some interviews regarding Greg's disappearance. And this is really my perception. I actually looked into this. Of course, this is what this update episode is all about. She really hasn't done much media over the years. And in fact, her interview with me was one of the few things that she has done in the 21st century regarding Greg's disappearance. That's not a criticism. That's just a fact. I don't know. But she has done actually some interviews here in 2024, and it's great to see. She certainly, if you don't know, she's a performer. She's performed in New York City all over the place, and she does a one woman show. She's very well known in the theater community of the United States. I don't know if she's ever been on any TV shows or movies or anything, but certainly within the theater community, she's very well known. And so she's done interviews about her performing and all of that, but these interviews are just geared toward Greg and his disappearance. I'm not going to read any articles, but really, just really what we went over in the interview that I did with her from a few years ago. But I'm so happy that she's doing that. I don't know how they came about. I haven't asked her. Was somebody like me finding out about her disappearance and just contacting her, or did she reach out to local media in California? I don't know. But it's so good to see that, because I know she hasn't done that, at least local media, for a very, very long time. So I'm hoping this is, once again, maybe I can only, I don't know, maybe I'm thinking too much of myself, but maybe her interview with me a couple years ago maybe finally kind of put her in the mood for that. Because the way I remember it, we got along great. She did a fantastic interview. On the other hand, I would not call her one of the more eager people to appear unfound. She wasn't resistant, but you should know there are some guests who, just, well, when are we going to do this? I'm ready to do this. And then there are others that really, 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 they're afraid. You got fear here, a lot of different fears and anxieties and everything. I just don't know how friendly Sherry was to the media, speaking about her missing husband. That's a tough conversation. So I'm hoping maybe that her talking to me maybe kind of started putting that in her mind that she needed to do that. And if so, I'm happy to have done that for her. Or it may just be a coincidence or something. But it's great to see her out there and being interviewed, especially local media. And maybe it will ring a bell. Somebody will remember something and, maybe put this on the front burner again for that area of California. Next update, Christian Balky Thompson. Christian Balky Thompson was a 26-year-old from Farnhamville, Iowa. He was a skateboarder and the father of two. In the early morning of hours of May 3rd, 2020, so we're coming up on the four-year anniversary, Christian was seen at a convenience store with a female friend. 36 hours later, Christian's car was found on fire at a farm. He was never seen again. If you will remember, that woman that knew Christian drove his car to this location, and then it seems that the guy who owned this property attempted to at least burn part of the car, but the whole car caught on fire, and then it caught his building on fire, and the fire department saw it, or somebody saw it, and the fire department shows up, they find Christian's car there. Now, obviously, that was not the way it was supposed to go down. Obviously, I think they were supposed to burn that car so nobody would ever know that the car was there, something like that. Didn't go as planned. And this also should kind of remind all of you, when you start thinking about these very intricate plans that you think were put into action to cause disappearances, people to disappear, always remember Christian Balky Thompson. No good plan goes unpunished. So the update is that there was a search, and I'm going to read about it right now. Law enforcement were seen digging at the 22,300 block, 22300 block of 150th Street in Carroll County, where missing person Christian Balky Thompson's vehicle was thought to be burned in 2020. It wasn't thought to be burned. It was burned. Carroll County Sheriff Ken Pingree said Thursday morning that the investigation is continuing with nothing new to report. Balky Thompson of Farnhamville was reported missing on May 3rd of 2020. He's still listed as a missing person by the Iowa Department of Public Safety. Balky Thompson was 26 when he was reported missing. He would now be 30. The day after Balky Thompson was reported missing, a shed fire was reported at that location. The property is about 5 miles north of Carroll and is in the vicinity of where law enforcement was seen digging on Wednesday. Recovered from the shed fire in 2020 was thought to be debris of a vehicle owned by Balky Thompson. Further information about the incident is being withheld until an investigation is complete. Anyone with information regarding the disappearance of Balky Thompson is asked to contact the Missing Persons Information Clearinghouse, Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation at 515-725-6036. So that was some weeks ago, if not months ago, that this search happened. And just so you know, so as to kind of follow up and see if anything came of this, I did reach out to Christian's mother, who was the guest, and she got back to me saying that at least to this point, nothing has turned up. I think it makes all the sense in the world to look at on that property. But on the other hand, I have to be open to the idea that it sounded to me like she drove his vehicle to that property and she was by herself. That's kind of the way when thinking about his disappearance, at least the way I remember it, I always had envisioned that she shows up with this car and tells this guy, you know, I got to get rid of this car. Here's what's going on. And so Christian wouldn't have been with her. Which means probably if he is deceased, he's not on that property. That's kind of the way my mind was working for his disappearance. But still, if they're going to have access to the property, they should dig out every square foot of it as far as I'm concerned, even though I personally may have a different idea of what really happened in this disappearance. But so far, nothing of any note came from that search. Next update, Paul Sanders. Paul David Sanders was a 17-year-old from Mesa, Arizona. He was originally from Missouri and very athletic. On August 14th, 2001, someone, the person may or may not have been Paul, driving Paul's truck was pulled over by law enforcement in Tucson. A chase ensued in which the driver escaped. The truck was later found wrecked several miles away with no signs of Paul. He was never seen again. The update here is that the work continues. It's kind of the same update, maybe from the last couple of these update episodes going back to last year, 2023. In which one of my assistants, Carrie, of course you heard from Carrie a couple months ago when I interviewed her in a special episode. Of course, I interviewed all of my assistants back then, Eric, Cherie, and Emily as well. But you got to hear from Carrie, and I think we did talk about Paul at least a little bit in that discussion. And I greatly respect Carrie's work. Probably if you don't know by now, I respect anybody's work who can keep things very grounded, very logical, and being able to keep the sensationalism out of the analysis. That's kind of who, of course, probably know that's who I am. And so those are the kinds of people that I like to work with. Although certainly there have been people whose work I respect that can sometimes get into sensational areas. But Carrie is working on this along with a longtime listener. Her name is Jill, who's also a member of the think tank. And once again, I greatly respect her work as well. Both have gotten to know Jill very well, respect her certainly as a person and the work that she does. And so when both of them say that they're pretty sure, not 100%, but pretty sure that the person in Paul's truck was not Paul, I really have to take that seriously. Not something I would have suspected or predicted or anything. In fact, going back to when One Unfound covered his disappearance, I was certainly under the impression that Paul was driving his truck. But so many things have been revealed. Even something as simple as the chase that allegedly happened, that chase did not go as police described it at the time in the story that's been told over the last 20 plus years. There's now paperwork to show that that is not exactly what happened. There was kind of a chase, and allegedly it got stopped because they ran into a rainstorm in Phoenix, which you might expect rainstorms there are somewhat rare. It's like having a rainstorm in Las Vegas, where I lived for 13 and a half years, maybe once a year or something. Well, that rainstorm probably didn't exist. And both Jill and Carrie have had problems dealing with multiple jurisdictions. Some have been very helpful, some of them not so helpful in trying to piece this all together. But one thing they keep coming back to is that Paul was probably not driving that truck. But like I said, the work continues, and I can't get into why they suspect he wasn't driving the truck. We're just going to leave it at that for now. And of course, they've been doing, they did their own podcast. I don't know when the next episode's going to come out. They started, I think, last year, did a couple episodes. I don't know if they've done anything since, but maybe if they get back into that, they will reveal more of what they've discovered. Totally up to them. It's their show. They can do whatever they want. I am really just a bystander at this point. Next update, the Pickering Six. Jay Boyle, Michael Cummins, Daniel Higgins, Jamie Lafaber, Robbie Rumbolt, and Chad Smith were six teenagers from Pickering, Ontario, Canada. In the early morning hours of March 18th, 1995, the group was at a party. They then were headed to a marina to goof around. Video caught three of them there minutes later. All of them were never seen again. Now, the update, as I foreshadowed earlier in this episode, is that the guest for that episode has very, very sadly died. And of course, his name was Bruce Ricketts. And he had been working on their disappearances for quite a while. Seemed like a fantastic guy, certainly a little bit of a character, I think Bruce was. And this was originally a disappearance, coincidentally, just talking about her in the previous update with Paul Sanders. Jill was the one who had said, Ed, you might think about covering the Pickering Six. Of course, I'm the one that came up with that name, but the disappearances of these men who seemingly disappeared up there in Canada all together seemingly went out on a boat on one of the Great Lakes and disappeared. And I can remember the first time, and of course when Jill, like I said, greatly respect her, when she says, Ed, you should look at this disappearance, I take it very seriously. And so I did, and ended up talking to Bruce, and it's one of those weird times where I remember the very, very first time I spoke to a guest. You have to imagine at this point, a lot of these conversations unfortunately run together, although the disappearances themselves are all very classified in my mind. All the conversations I've had with guests, after what, it's been, 300 some now. But for some reason, I remember Bruce's first conversation, maybe because I remember it was in my car. It was the summer of 2022, and I was driving to Illinois for the PDGA Masters World Disc Golf Tournament. Remember, I went up there, Peoria, Illinois, stayed with one of my best friends from college, Dave, and hung out with him for a while. And that was that trip. And I called him right when I was still in Florida. It was on my agenda. I said, I'm going to talk to this Bruce Ricketts guy while I'm in my car. And that's what I did. And of course, he eventually, a couple months later, appeared on Unfound. But he passed away. And even though this is kind of like what I say about John Paulus, of course, John Paulus is still alive, greatly respect their work. But in both cases, the way I look at their respective disappearances is different than what they think. Certainly Bruce was thinking along the lines that something of a foul play nature went on with these six young men. I am not as convinced of that. Of course, as you know, I don't hold that against anybody. Many of the guests and families, they think something happened. I think something different. It never affects whether I'm going to try to help them or not. Ever. Never affects that. And so even if Bruce had continued to live and we continued to talk about these six young men, we might have our differences, but certainly I would try to help him in whatever he wanted to do. My idea is that, as best as I can tell, because we were friends on Facebook, he never talked about any health issues or anything. So my perception is this was something that happened quite suddenly. And this happened actually on January 2nd of this year, 2024. I think one of his children posted something about it, that he had passed away, on his Facebook page. And this is a great loss. All of these guests, every one of them, like I said, it hurts every time. And the first thing I start wondering about, and even dare I say worrying about, is who is going to pick up the baton and keep moving it forward regarding all of these disappearances, even though I may think that one thing happened and the guest who is now deceased thought something different. I still worry about, is somebody going to pick up the baton and keep moving this forward, trying to really figure out what happened? Right now, I don't know if that's going to happen with these young men. I know maybe one or two of members of their family are out there, but really it was Bruce who kind of put it all together and would represent all of their disappearances, which I think is very important. I think that kind of keeps things simpler, in contrast to six different families doing their own media appearances and probably, possibly saying different things about the facts of that night and everything. I think when you can get one person who is a good person like Bruce was, and very organized and well-spoken, and it's kind of, I think, delved into this kind of mysteries like these before, it's very helpful. So I don't know who that's going to be. I hope somebody can take Bruce's place. But it's very sad. So this is the update. Bruce Ricketts, no longer with us, and I hope he rests in peace. And that ends part one of Unfound's update, episode number 17. Please now find part two on this podcast feed. I'm Ed Dunsell, and you've been listening to Unfound.